Perfectly. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. I'm borrowing my daughter's computer because it does a better job than mine. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. I don't know whether this counts as my fourth visit to Israel. I've been to Israel in the flesh three times, 2002, 2007, and 2018. So it is a pleasure to be with you. For me, it's the afternoon. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon here in Nova Scotia, Canada, on the East Coast, right on the Atlantic. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to share my screen. I have a number of slides that I will show you. I see my job today as twofold. I want to talk about Newton's studies of the Jerusalem Temple, but I also want to showcase some of the archival holdings of the National Library of Israel in Jerusalem. So I'm going to show you some images of manuscripts, Newton theological and prophetic manuscripts from the National Library of Israel. And they've been there since the late 1960s. So I will now try to share my screen. That works?
Yes.
All right, excellent. Okay, so let's begin. I want to preface my comments today with some comments about Newton's biography. He was born in Woolsthorpe in Lincolnshire in 1642. As it happens, he was born on Christmas Day, 1642. And this is Newton, the first portrait we have of Newton. It shows him around the age of 46, just after he published his famous book, The Principia Mathematica. Now I want to bring you with me into Newton's orchard. This is Newton's birthplace at Woolsthorpe Manor. It's about an hour north of Cambridge, where he ended up. And this is a wonderful picture here, which shows his home from his youth, and appropriately a double rainbow. This was taken by a Nova Scotia astronomer way back in 1980. It was just a nice coincidence that that double rainbow came up. So there is his house again. And there is the famous apple tree. It's over 350 years old. They've dated it, and it's still flourishing. Newton ended up at Trinity College, Cambridge in 1661, right after the restoration of the monarchy. There had been an interruption in the monarchy during the time of Oliver Cromwell. King Charles II came to the throne, and that's why they call it the Restoration Period. So you can see this is a very grand college, and this picture here shows it from the time that Newton lived there. Now, we are right now in the midst of a pandemic, and a pandemic hits in the 1660s, first in London, and then it spread to some of the outlying areas. And this engraving shows some of the devastation of that plague. It was the bubonic plague, otherwise known as the Black Death. And just as we're seeing now, they had to institute social distancing, and the University of Cambridge was closed down twice during this period. It closed down, and then it opened up again, and then they had a second wave, so it closed down again. And when this happened, both times, Newton went back to his home in Woolsthorpe. And he had just finished his undergraduate degree. He was in his early to mid-20s. And he finds himself back in Woolsthorpe. And it's at this time that the famous moment when the apple fell happened. And this gave Newton some insights into universal gravitation. And there is there are some apples there from one of the apple trees at Woolsthorpe Manor. So what we see is that the university closes twice in 1665 and 1666. And if you go online, you'll find lots of commentary about Newton's very productive Anni Mirabilis. That's Latin for his remarkable years, his miraculous years, or his wonder years. And this period of about 2 years, 18 months to 2 years, was very productive for Newton. The plague came to an end with the Great Fire of London in 1666, and Newton goes back to Cambridge. But while he's at Woolsthorpe, he lays some of the foundations of his famous calculus, a mathematical production, and secondly, he carries out important optical experiments on the nature of light and colors. And as I've already mentioned, that's when he saw the apple fall. And this leads to a chain of reasoning that gets him thinking about the universal nature of gravity. He wonders whether the same force that draws the apple to the Earth keeps the moon in orbit around the Earth. And indeed, he was correct. And this is what he said. He said, all this was in the two plague years of 1665 and 1666. For in those days, I was in the prime of my age of invention and minded mathematics and philosophy more than at any time since. They say that mathematicians peak around the age of 24. That's rather early. So that's why they always recommend if you want to go into mathematics, don't take any time off after high school. You go straight into mathematics. One of the fascinating things about this moment is what Newton records about being in a kind of contemplative mood when he saw the apple fall. And this is a rather important testimony. What we've seen from research in recent years is that it's when you're disconnected, also when you're out in nature, out in the country, that's when you can have some really original and creative ideas. And that's not what a lot of people are doing during the current lockdown. They are very much connected, as indeed we are now. I'm not suggesting that you disconnect now. Please wait until the talk is over. But there's a really good lesson to be learned from this, that Newton was relaxed, he had an open mind, and he was able to have these very important scientific thoughts during the plague years. So he ends up back at Cambridge, and he becomes a fellow, and there you can see his garden right in the center there with the trees. It's a walled garden. It's his own private garden, and it's right beside the Trinity College chapel. And on the end of the chapel, you can see in Latin, Domus mea domus oratationis vocabitur. And this is actually a quotation from the book of Isaiah. So the context is the words are directed to the eunuch and to the children of Gentiles who join themselves to the Lord and love the name of the Lord. Even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all people. Some translations have all nations. The Lord God, which gathereth the outcasts of Israel, saith, yet will I gather others to him besides those that are gathered unto him. Now, I don't know whether this full passage was always in Newton's mind when he was thinking about his studies on the temple, but it is interesting that that engraving is on the chapel. So he goes on to publish his very famous book, the Principia Mathematica, in 1687, and then in 1704, this time in English, he publishes his Optics, his famous book on optics. And this is how Newton had, how he achieved his fame, and his fame still largely rests on that. However, people are becoming increasingly aware of Newton's other projects, including his study of alchemy, but also, and that is relevant to what we're talking about today, his study of theology, prophecy, church history, doctrine, the texts, the Hebrew texts of the Tanakh, and the Greek text of the Christian New Testament. And you won't be able to see this in any detail, and that's not the point. I just want you to be overwhelmed with this very large collection of Newton's theology manuscripts, which can be found in Jerusalem. This is a tabulation that I drew up with the help of a research assistant a couple months ago. And we have all the word counts, and it is a very, very large collection. Indeed, it totals around 2 million words. So to put that in perspective, the total collection of Newton's theological manuscripts, which is strewn around the world, is about 3.5 million. So the majority of Newton's theological manuscripts are in Jerusalem. Now you may ask, how did they get there? Some of you I know are aware of this story. This is Abraham Shalom Yehuda. He was born in Jerusalem of an Iraqi Jewish family and went on to become a world-renowned scholar teaching at various institutions on both sides of the Atlantic. In 1936, Newton's non-scientific manuscripts were auctioned at Sotheby's in London. This is right in the middle of the Depression, and the Earl of Portsmouth was on hard times at that moment, and he decided to sell these manuscripts. So they sold, and a large number of them were bought by the economist John Maynard Keynes. Yehuda himself didn't make it to the sale. He found out about it a few weeks later, but once he found out about it, he began to buy very, very heavily, making deals with other purchasers, manuscript and book dealers, and he ended up with this large collection, which is now at the National Library of Israel. He wrote some books, two books on the ancient Near East. This book right here, The Language of the Pentateuch and Its Relation to Egyptian. This is a copy that I own. He gave it to the Jewish biblical scholar, Nahum Sarna, and you can see his letter to Professor Sarna. And this is another book that he published a little bit later, The Accuracy of the Bible. So that's A.S. Yehuda. This is one of the Yehuda manuscripts, and you can see that you may not be able to see it in a lot of detail, but in the upper left-hand corner, there is a Jewish blessing, Baruch Shem, etc. Newton did have some Hebrew. His Hebrew wasn't of a scholarly nature, but he did study Hebrew. His Latin, though, was fluent, and he knew Greek quite well also. Now, in 2003, a documentary was released by the BBC, and it was my job, although I didn't expect this to happen, to reveal to the world that Newton had made a so-called prediction about the date 2060. So you can see the date 2060 about halfway down, just above that red wax seal. This is the other side of that sheet. And this is a transcription where Newton is trying to figure out when the time of the end would happen. And in this particular calculation, he took the period of 1260 days, which he believes represented years from the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation and the New Testament. And he added, he took the year 800 and added 1260 to that to come up with the date 2060. This is the other manuscript, which has the date 2060 on it. Both of them are in Jerusalem. So the BBC documentary showed me with the first of those manuscripts, and then there was a headline that went around the world, first in Israel, and then it spread. So you can see that there are 57 years back in 2003 to the date 2060. In 2007, we held a manuscript exhibition at the National Library of Israel, and this is the guidebook. It's bilingual in Hebrew and in English, and this is the entrance to that exhibition, and I believe that archway is meant to evoke the Jerusalem temple, and as you walk inside, you can see Newton's sketch of the floor plan of the temple on the floor. And there you can see some of the visitors to the exhibition looking at Newton's manuscripts, which were placed on display for a few days. Well, this event also made the news. This is the headline in Haaretz, the newspaper, the English version, father of modern science, calculated world to end in 2060. Now, we had realized that there would be some interest in the 2060 manuscript, so we were very careful in our exhibition to explain that Newton did not believe that the Earth was going to be destroyed, that a comet was going to strike the Earth, or anything like that. In fact, for Newton, this time wasn't absolutely certain. He just believed that the time of the end wouldn't happen much earlier than 2060. And it's really not an end for Newton. It's more of a new beginning, because he believed that it would be around this time that the millennium would be established, a millennium in Christian terms, kingdom of God on earth, the messianic age in Judaic terms. So despite our very careful qualifications, the newspapers nevertheless picked up on the 2060 date. This one is a slightly more sober and reflective story that's talks about Newton's temple drawings. Now, I want to just flag some scholarship on Newton's studies of the temple. Tessa Morrison, who is based in Australia, a student of the history of architecture, has now published two books. This is a more scholarly book, and this more popular book, Isaac Newton and the Temple of Solomon. Also, a Spanish scholar, Morano Rodriguez, has published a full transcription and translation of Newton's most important manuscript on the temple. You can see Newton's sketch of the temple. That particular manuscript is now at the Huntington Library in Los Angeles. My colleague in the Newton Project, Rob Iliff, in 2017, published this book, Priest of Nature, The Religious Worlds of Isaac Newton. I encourage anyone interested in some of the themes of today's talk to go to this book. It's very well written and well researched. Rob is the editorial director of the Newton Project, which ironically is not based in Cambridge, it's based in Oxford. Rob Iliff did come to Israel in 2018, also earlier in 2007 for our exhibition and conference. I want to also point to some Israeli scholars who have worked on Newton. My Hebrew is, I have some biblical Hebrew and even less Israeli Hebrew, but I know that the title of this book is Isaac Newton and the Temple. This is Eva Leshem Ramati, who kindly gave me this book in 2007. It's all about Newton and the temple, and it's in the Hebrew language. And this is Ezra Harel's Hebrew language book on Newton. And there is the English translation. I was honored to help edit this translation and provide an endorsement for it. It's a wonderful book because it takes you through Newton's ideas on theology, but it also takes you through Mr. Harel's own voyage of discovery as he learns more about Newton's theology, Mr. Harel being a man of science himself. I encourage you to look to those books. Now, I want to set Newton's studies of the temple in their original context of the 17th and 18th centuries. Just to give you a little bit of background, what we're talking about here is an architectural plan that holds true from the tabernacle through to the first temple of Solomon and the second temple revived, rebuilt under the governor Zerubbabel after the return from the Babylonian captivity. I should say the partial return because many Iraqi Jews, of course, came back to Israel in the 20th century, including my friend Ezra Harel. And then it was renewed or renovated or even completely rebuilt by Herod into the first century. So this is the temple that is discussed, mentioned in the New Testament. Now the third temple, well, some scholars, some believers don't believe there will be a third temple. Some believers, some scholars do see a third temple. Insofar as people believe in the third temple, they look to Ezekiel's prophecy, that is Ezekiel 40 to 48. So this is an illustration of the tabernacle, and you can see there's the holy place and then the most holy, the inner sanctum, where the Ark of the Covenant is placed. This is an attempt to reconstruct what Solomon's temple would have looked like, the time of Solomon right up to its destruction in 587 BCE. And this is at the Israel Museum. I took this photograph in November 2018, and it shows you the Herodian version of the Second Temple. This is what is, of course, called the Temple Mount. There is no temple there now, obviously, but Newton and other believers saw the temple as being rebuilt in the future. Now, there are some interesting ideas about the temple that Newton picked up on, two in particular. So the first one is that the Jerusalem temple was thought to be a representation of the cosmos. Who believes this? Well, the Jewish historian Josephus, the Jewish philosopher Philo Judaeus, and many rabbinical writings take this view. And secondly, there is the argument that the Jerusalem temple is a representation of God's sanctuary in heaven. And we see this in the pseudepigrapha. We now know that the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls held that belief, and some other rabbinical writings as well. Newton certainly held to the first of those beliefs, that the temple was a representation of the cosmos. And he seems to have held also to a variation of number two. We'll get to that in a few moments. Now, Baroque temples. There was a real fashion in the 17th century to produce reconstructions of the temple. And so two Spanish Jesuits who did this are Prado and Villalpando. In their massive commentary on the temple in Ezekiel's prophecy. Now, they took the view that the temple of Ezekiel's prophecy was more of an allegory, more of a spiritual message, and they didn't see a literal temple to be rebuilt. Then you also have Jacob Judah Leon, who was nicknamed Templo, a Dutch Sephardic Jewish biblical and Talmudic scholar, who produced a recreation of the temple. And both of these works are much emulated in this period. There's a lot of discussion about architecture and its origins. So one view is that the plan of the temple comes from God, and this is the foundation for all later temples, some of which were corruptions, but nevertheless, this is the foundation for temples and, to a certain extent, all architecture. And then the Roman architect Vitruvius, his book on architecture was rediscovered in the Renaissance, and he put forward a more secular view that architecture had developed from the primitive hut. He had this notion that structures ideally have three qualities: stability, utility, and beauty. But some people combine these two views, and Juan Battista Villalpando was one of those. He believed that, in fact, that Vitruvius had obtained his architectural ideas from Solomon's temple, that Vitruvius was, in effect, a plagiarist. Well, here's the grand Baroque structure that Villalpando recreated on the basis of his study of the book of Ezekiel and other sources. As you can see, it looks very much like a Baroque structure, like something that would have been created in the early modern period. And of course, scholars then had no access, virtually no access, to archaeology of the ancient Near East, and reconstructions of the temple, we've already seen a couple, are much more accurate today. But you can see that these are very intricate engravings, and you can also imagine how people would have found these endlessly fascinating. This is the top-down view of Villalpando's reconstruction. And in the geometrical center there, you can see the are the altar of burnt offerings. And that's an important feature, which I will come back to. This is a model of the temple, partly based on Villopando, partly deconstructed, but this is what remains of it. And it was built in Hamburg in Germany in the 1690s, sponsored by a man named Gerhard Schott. And this model actually toured in England in the 1720s, in the last decade of Newton's life. This is another reconstruction of the temple platform and the temple by another scholar. So this is in the air. People are interested in the temple. They're studying the temple, and they have various motivations for doing that. Some people were interested in the history of architecture. Others believe that there were spiritual and mystical symbols in the Jerusalem temple that could be unlocked by a careful study. And others associated the temple with their study of prophecy. And this is the most important starting point for Newton himself. So here are three prophetic motivations for Newton to study the temple. Number one, the Jerusalem temple was the scene, this is what Newton believed, it was the scene for the symbols of the apocalypse. That is to say, the book of Revelation, the last book in the Christian New Testament. And he believed that understanding the layout of the temple and its rituals would help unlock the meaning of this prophecy. So that is one of his motivations. But he also saw the dates for the destruction of the first temple, 587 BCE, and the destruction of the first temple was destroyed by the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar, the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And then the destruction of the second temple, Herod's temple, in 70 CE by the Romans. At both moments, there is a dispersion of Jewish captives, and this is why we still have a diaspora today, of course. So Newton saw these as demarcation points for some of his prophetic time periods. But Newton also believed, he didn't write as much about this, but he also believed that in the future, the temple would be rebuilt and that the Jews would return to their land. He wrote quite a bit about the Jews returning to their land, not as much about the future of the temple, but this was his belief. So Newton, in other words, did believe in a third temple. He had some other motivations for studying the temple, a general interest in the Bible. That's kind of a cavalier, relaxed way of putting it. Newton was absolutely passionate about the Bible. He studied it all his life. And John Locke, his friend, the philosopher, said that he didn't know anyone who knew the Bible better than Newton. He could quote it from memory. He spent much of his life studying the Bible. Also an interest in Jewish ritual and its relationship to the early Christian church. So this would involve the tabernacle and the temple worship services. There is his belief that the plan of the temple mapped the cosmos. And number four, he has an interest in ancient metrology. This is the study of measurement. And this includes such things as the Roman foot. How long is the Roman foot? But especially the sacred cubit of the Jews. He's very interested in trying to find out how long that was, because that will help him to reconstruct the temple. Now, when Newton was a relatively young man in the 1670s, he encountered the prophetic writings of Joseph Mead of Christ College, Cambridge. Mead died 4 years before Newton was born, so they never met, but Newton did acquire a copy of his works. So this is Mead's Clavis Apocalyptica, the key of the apocalypse. And this is Newton's very own copy of Joseph Mead's works from 1672. It was a kind of an accident, but I discovered this at the Huntington Library, where it had not been fully cataloged. And it has all kinds of dog ears in it. And I'll show you those after I just mentioned this. Say something about this wonderful fold-out plate. So this is Joseph Mead's attempt to take the symbols of the book of Revelation and put them on a timeline. So the arrow of time starts on the left and goes right through to the right, and you can see the Latin word finis there, which means the end. So Meade and Newton did not believe that the Book of Revelation was merely symbolic and merely allegorical. They believed that it would unfold through Christian history from the time of Christ right up to the time of the end, and also that there would be a 1,000-year millennium when Christ would reign on earth. In fact, Meade helps revive this idea in the English context. Newton held to that view. So it's essentially the same idea as the Messianic Age in Judaism. Here you can see one of Newton's dog ears, and this is the inside of it. And so we're not allowed to fold them because we want to preserve the artifacts. So what we've been doing is creating these virtual dog ears. And Newton would fold the page to point to a portion of the text that was interesting to him. This is from Meade's works. And you can often cross-reference these page markings to his manuscript. On that page, you can see the Latin mille annos, which is just to the right and above the point of the triangle there. That's 1,000 years in Jerusalem. This is the first page of one of Newton's earliest, in fact, it is, we think, the earliest treatise that he wrote on the Book of Revelation. This is in Jerusalem, part of the Yehuda collection. Here's the same manuscript, Newton's rules for interpreting the words and language of Scripture. He believed that the prophetic books of Daniel and the Book of Revelation were written in a prophetic language, and you had to learn that language if you wanted to understand these prophecies. But Meade is also interested in the temple. He's interested in the measurements of the temple. He sees time periods embedded in the proportions of the temple architecture. He believes that the scene of the Book of Revelation is the temple. So Newton picks up these ideas from Meade. This is from Newton's copy of Meade, an engraving of the temple. And here you see one of the Yehuda manuscripts. And at the very bottom, upside down, and I'll give you that flipped up, the Latin there says the scene of the vision of the apocalypse is Judea and principally the temple with its atria or its rooms. And there you see in one of the Yehuda manuscripts a map of the Near East. There's an enlarged version of it, and you can see that he has Jerusalem down there. You can see the Dead Sea above it, Damascus, above that, Aleppo in Syria, and Baghdad and Nineveh are over on the right. So he sees the larger geography of Judea as being the geography of the Book of Revelation, but in particular, the Jerusalem temple. So here's one of the Yehuda manuscripts where he articulates this idea. The temple formed according to the proportions of the tabernacle, being the scene of these visions, of it that you may understand the visions better, I will first describe the temple. And then in additional places, he says the tabernacle or temple is the common scene of all the apocalyptic visions. For the land of Judea and therein the temple is the common scene of all the apocalyptic visions. So you need to understand the geography of Judea, of ancient Israel. You need to understand the architecture of the temple if you're going to understand the apocalyptic visions. And the temple as being God's dwelling place and a representation of heavenly things is put for heaven. So you can see that Newton here is hinting at that second view of the temple that I mentioned earlier, which is held in the Dead Sea Scrolls, etc. And then the scene of the visions to be Judea, and in Judea, the temple. So this is one very compelling reason for Newton to study the temple, because he wants to understand the apocalypse. here's a depiction of the great white throne with 24 elders bowing down. An animator has created this image. So this is the sort of thing that Newton is trying to do. He's trying to imagine the scenes of the Book of Revelation, and he sees in the symbols various features of the temple, the trumpets being part of temple worship, the singing part of the temple worship, the fire, the altar burnt offerings, the fire, the sea mingled with fire. That would be the large wash basin with the reflection of the fire from the altar burnt offerings. So this is the way he's thinking. Okay, Isaac Newton's temple studies proper. Let's say a little bit about that. Newton looked to the Bible as his main source for the understanding of the temple, in particular the descriptions that you have of Solomon's temple and the much more detailed descriptions of Ezekiel's temple in chapters 40 to 48. Now, Newton does seem to believe that there is a very close similarity between Solomon's temple and Ezekiel's temple. Not all scholars believe that. In fact, one of his followers, William Whiston, who I'll mention at the end, did not believe that. He believed that Ezekiel's temple was larger and different in many respects, and it was important to make that distinction. But Newton also goes to other sources, including Maimonides, and this is a Latin translation from Maimonides, the Sefer Avodah, and that he had a copy of that in his library. Now, the single most important manuscript that Newton wrote about the temple is his Prolegomena, and this is the manuscript, I alluded to it briefly earlier. It is now at the Huntington Library in just outside of Los Angeles. It's part of the Babson collection, and it was moved there in around 2006. This is Newton's most detailed sketch of the temple, and you can see it there. And it's very important for him that the altar of burnt offerings is in the geometrical center. I'll come back to that, but you can see it's not just the temple, but it's also the entire temple platform, the courtyards, everything. Here is his sketch, a side profile with measurements of the altar as depicted in Ezekiel's prophecy, and then some other sketches here, various architectural features of the temple. So he spent a lot of time looking at various sources, looking at the Bible, looking at Jewish sources, any sources he could get his hands on to try to reconstruct the temple. Here you see from the National Library of Israel a manuscript about Ezekiel 40 and chapters following. You can see Latin there, but you can also see a little bit of Hebrew. Well, at least I can see it. You'll have to trust me, it is there. And this is also from the National Library of Israel. So the really grand manuscript is in Los Angeles, but there are other manuscripts on the temple at Jerusalem. And this is one where you can see some sketches, much more rudimentary sketches, but there they are. This manuscript also at the National Library of Israel, it has at the top of the page there of the temple and synagogues of the Jews. So he wants to study the temple, but also the synagogues of the Jews. And this is part of his study of church history and prophecy. Here are Newton's notes from Maimonides by way of this Latin translation, De Cultu Divino. The manuscript there is a little bit faded, but it has been preserved carefully at the National Library of Israel. And it is now, as you can see, nicely digitized as well. Here you can see Newton's notes on Villalpando. He didn't take too many notes on Villalpando, but he was aware of his writings. And this is also at the National Library of Israel. Here you see again at the National Library of Israel, a text, and the Latin there at the top of the page says concerning the length, the magnitude of the sacred cubit. So he wants to understand how long the cubit is. He needs to know that because you need to know that to understand the dimensions, the true dimensions of the temple. And Newton was very interested in doing that. This one right here is in a private collection, but it's also a manuscript that has his calculations from various sources of the length of the cubit. Okay, the temple in the world to come. Here's a wonderful chart. There are various versions of this chart at the National Library of Israel. This is one of them. And what it is it's Newton's attempt to create a schematization of the various symbols of the Book of Revelation or the Apocalypse. Now, you can't see the text in any detail, but you can see certainly that there's a great deal of care that has gone into producing this. And I will tell you that time, the arrow of time, moves from the top of the manuscript right down to the bottom. And here's a close-up of the bottom right-hand corner where he's using language from the Book of Revelation, which also comes originally from the Book of Isaiah, a new heaven and new earth. New Jerusalem comes down from heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. So this is the Messianic age that Newton sees coming in the future. And you can see I've underlined his one example of his use of the word Jerusalem. And then at the bottom, you can see the stamp of what used to be called the Jewish National University Library with the Hebrew for Jerusalem. So it's kind of nice to see the English there, Jerusalem, and then Yerushalayim in the Hebrew. So this is, again, one of the manuscripts at the National Library of Israel. So what Newton believes is that in the future, he is a Christian, so he believes in the return of Christ. But unlike most Christians, he does not believe in the doctrine of the Trinity. He believes that the doctrine of the Trinity is a corruption of the original pure monotheism. And it's very interesting because if you look at Newton's manuscripts, you will see that he believes that the original religion, the religion of Noah and his family, was a pure monotheism that was untainted with idolatry. And in his manuscripts, he talks about this early religion, and he says that the temples of these early worshipers were meant to depict a heliocentric cosmos with the sun in the center. And the sun is represented by an altar where fire is burned. Now, Newton doesn't believe that the first religion was a form of pagan polytheism. Rather, again, as I said, he believes that the original religion was pure monotheism, practiced by Noah and his family. But then over the centuries, it became corrupted and became polytheistic and lapsed into idolatry. So Newton believes this about the original religion, but he also believes that the original religion recognized that there was a creator, that there was one God who created the world and humans and animals and everything. And he believed that the priests of this early religion, this early monotheistic religion, were both astronomers and also religious priests, and they studied the heavens. Now he's thinking a little bit here of the Babylonian magi, of course. Now, he also believes in the seven precepts of the sons of Noah. So he believes that before the time of Moses, the Gentiles held to these seven precepts, and one of them is to refrain from idolatry and to be monotheist. Another is not to be cruel to animals. Another is to set up magistrates. So Newton wrote about this, and this for him was the original religion that had become corrupted. So why am I telling you all this? Well, it's part of the science side of Newton's study of the temple, but it will also come back now to this image right here. And Newton believes that the original religion is going to be restored. He is, as I said, a Christian, but he doesn't believe in the Trinity. So he believes that the majority of Christians have fallen astray, and that the true, pure form of Christianity is going to be restored at the time of the end. And this would happen at some time in the future, perhaps around the date 2060 or afterwards. Here is another manuscript from the National Library of Israel. And it looks kind of messy, but I have a transcription here for you. And here we see Newton speaking about the building of a new temple. This is Yehuda manuscript 7.1c. The Israelites in the days of the ancient prophets, when the 10 tribes were led into captivity, expected a double return from captivity, and that at the first, the Jews should build a new temple inferior to Solomon's until the time of that age should be fulfilled, and afterwards they should return from all places of their captivity and build Jerusalem and the temple gloriously. So here is a place where Newton argues that the ancient Jews believed there would be two returns from captivity. There would be a return from the Babylonian captivity, which happens in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, a partial return, as I mentioned earlier. But then that that second temple would be destroyed. Herod's temple would be destroyed, and that was in 70 CE. So there would have to be another return to the land of Israel. So he sees two returns, including one that was still future from his point of view. And at that time, around that time, the temple would be built, a much grander temple than even Solomon's. He sees worldwide peace being instituted. This is also from the Yehuda collection. 'Tis in the last days that this is to be fulfilled, and then the captivity shall return and become a strong nation and reign over strong nations afar off. And the Lord shall reign in Mount Zion from henceforth forever, and many nations shall receive the law of righteousness from Jerusalem. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nations shall not lift up a sword against a nation, neither shall they learn war anymore, all which never yet came to pass. So what Newton is saying is that interpreters who believe that that the language that you see here from Isaiah chapter 2 and Micah chapter 4, that it would be fulfilled maybe in the church, or maybe it was fulfilled at the time of the return from the Babylonian captivity, Newton says, no, this hasn't been fully fulfilled yet. He believes it's going to happen in the future. And here you see he's actually quoting from Isaiah 2 and Micah chapter 4 from the Yehuda collection. Okay, now I want to wind down. We've been going for maybe about 45 minutes or so. So another 5 minutes or so, and we'll conclude. The reception of Newton's temple studies. Well, after Newton passed away in 1727, some of his writings on prophecy were published in this book, Observations Upon the Prophecies of Daniel and the Apocalypse of St. John, 1733. And there you see a printed version of that text that is now in Jerusalem about the return of the Jews, the double return, and the temple being built gloriously in the future. In other words, a third temple. And also, shortly after his death in 1728, the book that Newton was writing in his dying days, The Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms Amended, which is a history book about ancient empires. And in this book is this wonderful engraving of based on Newton's sketches of the temple, which we've already seen. And this one right here is a close-up of the temple. And as you might be able to see, but I'll tell you if you can't, in the lower right-hand corner, copyright Jewish National and University Library. So this is actually held by the National Library of Israel. This was part of the exhibition from 2007. And here's another engraving from Newton's chronology. And you can see at the bottom, again, I will tell you if you can't see it, a scale of sacred cubits. And we've seen that the sacred cubit is important for Newton. And indeed, in 1737, Newton's writings in Latin on the sacred cubit were translated into English and published as an appendix to the works of John Greaves, who had actually visited the pyramids of Egypt and wrote quite a bit about the cubit. This is Newton's follower, William Whiston, who succeeded him at the Lucasian Professorship of Mathematics in Cambridge. Whiston not only was a convert to Newton's science, but he was an acolyte of his theology and prophecy. And this is Newton's sketch time chart of the Book of Revelation. And Whiston was much bolder than Newton, who did not want to make firm predictions. But in this case, Whiston has actually calibrated the chart with centuries. You can see going right up to the year 2000. This is from 1706, by the way. This is what Whiston, Newton's follower, believed about the Jewish restoration. I observed that the restoration of the Jews to their own land in general and the rebuilding of their temple with the restoration of their sacrifices according to Ezekiel's description and model is not a thing of doubt or uncertainty in the prophetic writings, but the thing that above all others they everywhere foretell and describe in the plainest and most emphatical words imaginable. Now, what Whiston is saying, and this is long before Newton's death, Newton would have known about this text, is that the temple that is described in the book of Ezekiel, the temple of Ezekiel's vision, is going to be rebuilt. Whiston was absolutely certain about that, and he believes that it's going to be a grander, larger temple complex than that of Solomon or Herod. This is Whiston's recreation of the temple platform. And as with Newton and many others, the altar of burnt offerings is in the geometrical center. Remember, Newton believed that that altar represented the sun in the heliocentric solar system. And at the bottom, you can see some engravings. There's a close-up of the temple, even closer. You can see the altar of burnt offerings there. And there's a perspective view of the temple. That one's actually a little more accurate than some of the other ones we've seen. This map was published in Newton's follower, Whiston's translation of the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus. And this is a sketch showing Whiston. He's the figure in black with a cane on the far right of this sketch, walking away from the crowd. This is Tunbridge Wells in the late 1740s, which was a resort town. And what Whiston did is he had a model of the Jerusalem temple belt in the 1720s, and he would take it on tour and he would lecture about it. And so this is one of those lectures depicted here in this sketch. Just before I conclude, I want to answer a question that maybe some people will have. Given Newton's interest in the temple, was he a Freemason? The answer is we have no evidence that Newton ever became a Freemason or that he was a member of the Rosicrucians. What we do know is that two of his supporters did become Masons. John Theophilus de Zegulies was the third Grand Master of England in London in 1719, and William Stukeley, who picked up Newton's interest in temples, became a Mason in 1721. So at least two of Newton's followers became Masons, but we have no evidence that Newton himself did. Okay, so I promised we would conclude about 5 or so minutes ago, and we are about to do that now, at least formally. What can we say? Well, if you want to look more deeply into Newton's theological manuscripts, I would encourage you to visit the Newton Project, the main website of the Newton Project, newtonproject.ox.ac.uk. You can search the manuscripts using a search engine. For example, if you want to, you can search for the word temple and see all the times that Newton has used the word temple. We have about 95% of Newton's theological manuscripts in transcription, searchable transcription. We're not quite there with all of them, but in the next year or so, we should have them all available. And sorry, the bottom one there, isaacnewton.ca, is the Newton Project Canada, which I run here in Canada. I have have transcribers who do transcription work, but all of that transcription work goes to the Newton Project website. We're near the end of our funding cycle. We have almost completed the transcription of the 3.5 million words of theology. We are still happy, of course, to accept donations. We can't provide tax receipts for Israelis, but we can provide US, Canadian, and British tax receipts. And I've given you a sense of how much it costs to transcribe a single page. It's about $20 to $50 US, depending on how messy the text is. So that's all I have to say formally. If we were at the National Library of Israel, we would no doubt be very close to the Ardon stained glass window display. This is a picture I took of it in 2007, and I thought that would be a nice and a fitting end to our presentation. In this stained glass window installation,